The boy looked no older than 2 or 3 and had something in his hand, a toy dinosaur. As the woman approached, she looked at Dell and came to an abrupt stop. She said something under her breath to the boy, gripped his hand, turned, and walked back in the direction of the stairwell. The boy looked over his shoulder at Dell, and the mother quickly admonished him.
"Excuse me," Dell said.
The woman did not turn around.
"Excuse me,"
Dell increased his volume and his pace, what his skimpy back allowed.
"Miss Reynoso? Miss Reynoso?"
The name was in the FIT reports. Dell caught up with the woman just before she pushed the door handle leading to the stairwell.
"Miss Reynoso?
No hablo inglés."
She smiled apologetically and looked frazzled.
"Hablas español?"
She shook her head.
"Tengo prisa. No puedo hablar ahora."
She was in a hurry and could not talk now. Dell had taken Spanish in high school, and he'd worked in Eastern Washington when he first graduated from the academy. He could speak and understand street Spanish, though he was far from fluent. He didn't need to understand any Spanish to know Reynoso was lying. He pointed to her apartment door and asked why she had turned around when she'd been coming home.
¿Estabas volviendo a casa? ¿Por qué tú volviste cuando me viste?
No, no, I can't talk now. I'm late.
So you do speak English?
She paused.
Sí, yes, a little.
Why did you turn around when you saw me?
Reynoso looked frightened.
Please.
Dell held up his badge.
I'm a detective with the Seattle Police Department, he said, though Reynoso seemed unimpressed with his credentials. I'd like to ask you a few more questions. Do you want to talk in your apartment or here in the hallway?
Reynoso didn't have to talk to Dell at all, but most citizens didn't know this. Resigned, Reynoso nodded to her apartment and they walked the hallway together. At the door, Dell gave her some space. The boy looked up at him with both suspicion and trepidation. Dell smiled, but it didn't change the look on the kid's face. Reynoso opened the door and stepped into the apartment. Dell looked past her into the apartment, not seeing anyone inside. She put the bag of groceries on the counter and spoke to the boy.
Daniel, ve a jugar a tu cuarto con tu dinosaurio.
Daniel looked from his mother to Dell, as if afraid to leave her.
Seguid, she said. Haré quesadillas en el rato.
The boy walked to the door on the other side of the room, glancing back at Dell a final time before going through it. The woman crossed her arms around her body and lowered her chin.
You were here the other night when Eduardo Lopez was shot. I just want to ask you a few questions, Dell said.
I've already talked to the police. You should ask them.
She spoke without raising her gaze.
I did, Dell said. They sent me back out because your story doesn't match the other witnesses. They asked me to try to determine why that is, why your story is different.
The woman responded with a shoulder shrug, but no words.
A woman down the hall said she heard a woman yell gun just before she heard the shots. You said you heard a man yell gun.
There was no such report. Reynoso shook her head.
I don't know.
Dell changed tactics.
How did you know Eduardo Lopez?
He lived next door.
Did you have a relationship with him?
No.
She shook her head, frowning.
Then what was he doing here in your apartment?
I told...
No, you didn't answer that question. No one asked you that question. What was he doing here in your apartment?
Dell had read the witness statements, including hers. She shrugged, buying time.
He just came here.
You were friends?
Sí, yes, we were friends.
How did you meet?
I told you, he lived next door.
Where did he work?
I don't know.
What did he talk about?
Please, she said. I have to feed my boy.
Why did you say you heard a man yell gun, Miss Reynoso?
Because that's what I...
No, that's not what you heard. The police wear body cameras now. Do you know what a body camera is? It's a tiny video camera, Miss Reynoso. It videotapes everything that happens and records everything that is said.
The officers didn't wear cameras, at least not all officers, and not yet, anyway. That issue was still being negotiated between the city and the police union. Dell was just pressing her to see if she changed her story.
So we know that a man did not yell gun. Why did you say that he did?
I don't know. Maybe I make a mistake.
Miss Reynoso, you can't get in trouble for telling the truth. But if you lie to a police officer...
Please.
Did someone tell you to say that you heard a man yell gun?
Please.
Did someone tell you to say that?
You tell me too.
She raised her voice and her gaze.
You, the police, the woman, she say you heard a man yell gun.
Now, they were getting someplace.
Did you? I don't know. It was loud and Daniel was crying. I told her I don't know what I hear. But she say again, you heard a man yell gun, didn't you? So I say, okay, I hear a man yell gun. Then she say, and you heard me ask him, the other police, why you yell gun?
Did you hear her say that to the other officer? Reynoso shook her head.
I don't hear nothing. I just say it because she say to.
Did she say why she wanted you to say that?
She say Eduardo Lopez, he shoot someone. She say I'm hiding him and could be in trouble, that I could lose Daniel if I no say it. So I say it.
Were you hiding Lopez? She shook her head, emphatic.
No. He knock on my door and say someone coming to his apartment. He say he need to not be there.
He knew someone was coming?
He say he need a place to go until they go. I tell him I don't want to be involved. But he say only for a minute. He say there are immigration.
So you let him in?
I was afraid. He had men at his apartment all the time.
Do you know why? She shook her head. Was he selling drugs? A shrug.
I don't know.
Was he in a gang?
I don't know.
Did he say who was coming to his apartment? Who he was hiding from? Another shrug.
He just say immigration.
Del thought of what Foz had told him and moved close to Reynoso's apartment door. Was he standing by your door? She nodded.
He listening. Someone in the hallway knocking on his door and...
You heard someone knocking? Del asked. Foz said Gonzalez never got the chance to knock.
Yes, they knock hard. Bam, bam, bam.
Del pointed to her apartment door. On this door?
No, his door. Next door.
You heard someone knocking?
Yes. Bam, 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 like that.
Del thought of something else and asked, Were you talking to Lopez? She shook her head.
I no say nothing.
The officers who came said they heard someone speaking in Spanish. Was Lopez speaking to you in Spanish? She shook her head but stopped. Do you recall something?
Someone call his phone. He's speaking Spanish on his phone.
What did Lopez say?
I don't know.
You don't remember anything he said? She shook her head. Was this before or after you heard someone knocking? Did he get the call before or after someone knocked on his door?
After.
Reynoso appeared to be fighting the effects of a headache.
Someone bang on the door, but Lopez, he just listen. He no answer. Then no more banging, and Lopez, he go to the window,
she said, pointing. Del walked to the window. From it, he could see the parking lot. He walked over here and looked out the window after he heard someone knocking?
He hears knocking. Then he walks to the window, watching. Then he looks at me and he says, Gracias, and he starts to leave. Then his phone rings.
It explained why the phone was in Lopez's hand when he walked out the apartment door, and possibly why he had surprised Foz and Gonzalez. Whoever Lopez had been hiding from, whoever had knocked on his apartment door, Lopez believed that person had left, maybe even saw him leave from Reynoso's window. He wasn't expecting anyone to be outside when he opened Reynoso's door, and without a peephole, he had no way to check before he did so. Foz and Gonzalez had surprised him, and he had surprised them. 38. Tammy Peterson lived on Capitol Hill, but told Tracy she'd meet them at a corner pub called the Stumbling Monk. She sounded young and enthusiastic, brimming with excitement, and not the least bit intimidated to be meeting detectives. Tracy and Kins hoped Peterson could help them get a better handle on sugar dating, information they might be able to use if Shay were reluctant to talk to them, or if he lied. The more they knew, or Shay thought they knew, the more they could push him out of any comfort zone. Peterson had been literal when she described the Stumbling Monk as a corner pub.
The entrance to the brick single-story building faced the intersection of East Olive Way and Belmont Avenue East, just beneath a sign of a bald monk and beer kegs. Kins pulled open a solid wood door with iron bolts and hinges intended to depict a medieval abbey. The decor inside the pub was austere. Half a dozen bar stools lined a nicked and scraped wooden bar. Televisions were noticeably absent, along with their persistent chatter. A bookcase supplied well-worn paperbacks and board games. A handful of people sat on bar stools or at tables and booths, sipping Belgian beers, a handwritten list to choose from on a whiteboard. Tracy spotted Peterson sliding from one of the booths to greet them. She looked a lot more like her working picture in the newspaper article, black eyeglasses, blue jeans, sandals, and a sleeveless white blouse. The three introduced themselves, and Tracy and Kins slid into the booth across from her. Peterson had a cup of black coffee on the table and her laptop computer open.
"Interesting place," Kins said, considering an old-fashioned bicycle perched on the roof of a closet in the back corner.
"I come down here to write," Peterson said. "It gives me a break from my apartment and at least makes me feel like I got out during the day."
"What do you write?" Tracy asked.
"Whatever pays. Mostly freelance articles, local scene-type stuff. And yes, I am one of those people writing a novel."
"Anything published?" Tracy asked.
"Haven't finished it yet," Peterson said. "I'm a great procrastinator. It's sort of a literary romance." She shrugged and sipped her coffee. "My editor said you were interested in the article I wrote on sugar dating. That was almost 2 months ago."
"We'd like to ask you some questions about your research," Kins said.
"My undercover work as a sugar baby?" Peterson smiled. "Can I ask what this is about? You're both wearing wedding rings, so I assume neither of you is interested in creating a profile, though that didn't stop some of the men."
Tracy and Kins returned her smile.
"We're working on a case. A young woman apparently did some dating," Tracy said, "and we'd like to find out more about it. From reading the article, it sounds like you put in a lot of time and effort."
"Homicide case?" Peterson asked. The young woman had done her research, and Tracy could see the journalism wheel spinning. She'd be on the internet the minute they left, trying to figure out who had died, and then she'd try to look up her profile.
"Yes, but we have no information the two are related. We're just starting to run it down."
"But she had a profile, and she was dating men from her profile?"
"That's what we're told," Tracy said. "From the tone of your article, I got the impression you didn't think much of the concept of sugar dating."
"You mean my line about it promising a Ferrari and more times than not producing a Kia? I thought I was being subtle."
"We saw through it," Kins said, returning Peterson's smile. "We're highly trained detectives."
"Honestly, I found the whole thing kind of sad. Some of the girls I spoke with saw this as their Pretty Woman moment. You know, the movie with Julia Roberts?"
Tracy did, and thought the concept of a prostitute and a millionaire falling in love and living happily ever after more than a little far-fetched.
"And that's not how every encounter turns out?" Kins said with mock surprise. "I'm shocked."
"I'm sure some of the sugar daddies tell themselves they're being supportive, helping these girls realize dreams, that they're mentors or something." She shrugged again, a habit.
"You can pretty much tell yourself whatever you want to hear, and I guess you'll eventually start to believe at least some of it. Other guys I spoke to were more practical. They tell themselves that at least they're not hiring a prostitute."
"And how do the girls rationalize it?" Tracy asked. "Those not living the Pretty Woman dream."
"That's what's so sad. Some of the girls told me they figured they were being used, but at least they were getting paid for it. Some said the money was supplementing their income, and a few said they were still in school and needed the money to pay bills."
Peterson shrugged again, this time accompanied by a frown.
"From my perspective, everyone was on the hustle, and everyone thought they were winning. Nobody really was.
The websites say these women are making upwards of $3,000 or more a month," Tracy said.
"I take it you didn't find that to be true?"
"The websites say a lot of things," Peterson sat back. "I don't know, maybe a few are making that much, but I couldn't verify it, and the large majority I spoke with were basically making spending money. I look at it this way. How many guys can afford $3,000 a month for a girlfriend?" she said.
From my research, a man can get a really good-looking prostitute for $400 to $500. So if it happened, I'm betting it wasn't often.
How are these dating sites even legal? Kins asked. Did you find anything about why this isn't considered prostitution? The concept of money for sex seems pretty blatant.
The websites fly under the radar of local law enforcement because they forbid any specific agreement to exchange cash for sex. From what I was told by vice officers, to be considered prostitution, there has to be an explicit agreement that is consummated immediately or very soon after the agreement is reached. These sites that call themselves dating sites say they're providing companions and that sex is not the primary motivation.
But it is a motivation, Tracy said. From your experience?
The article indicated that while at the seminar in Los Angeles, Peterson had been approached by two men wanting to walk across the street to a hotel and have group sex. From the research I did, sex was a big part of the package. It always came up. There might have been other things discussed, but sex was definitely on the table.
What do the website owners say about that? Tracy asked.
They say sex is always on the table when two people enter a relationship and begin dating, but neither is obligated to have sex unless he or she wants to. She gave them a rueful smile. At the same time, these websites let women know up front that these are relationships with no complications and no strings attached. No love is expected or welcomed. So, no love, just sex, and the women get paid money. What does that sound like to you?
Who signs up on these sites? Tracy asked.
No way to know for certain, Peterson said. Everything is kept confidential. The women are encouraged to use fake names and fake profiles, and I'm sure the men do also. There's a lot of smoke and mirrors and, frankly, a lot of stupidity. Think about the scenario of 19-year-old women getting into cars with men they don't know anything about, not even their real names. All they know is what they read on the profile, and often they haven't told anyone what they're doing because they're too embarrassed to be doing it.
And much of what is on the dating site is probably bullshit, Kin said.
Peterson leaned forward, animated. I interviewed a mental health therapist for the article, and she said these relationships remind men of that carefree time in their lives when they were young and dating. Except this time, the men have the money, so they have the power. They control the situation, and they can steer the relationship in directions they couldn't when they were just dating. She said the result is a huge power imbalance. The average age of guys using these sites is 45. The average age of the women is 26. She said you also have gender imbalance and possibly class and race imbalance, which raises the question of whether the girls are really consenting or are just so desperate for money either because they've lost their job, can't pay the rent, or can't see a way to make their dream come true working at Starbucks part-time for minimum wage. Peterson shrugged. Everyone wants to blame the women and give the men a free pass when really the men are just as guilty, if not more so.
Tracy glanced at Kins, but he ignored her.
Peterson said, I have to tell you, I never expected I'd be talking to homicide detectives when I concluded the article the way that I did. But I guess it doesn't surprise me.
How do you conclude the article? Kins asked.
The internet is a dangerous place, Peterson said, without looking at her computer. You can go online and protect your identity, but then so can the person you're targeting. It can be a very deadly game. 39. Dell parked his 1965 Hunter Green Impala well back from the basketball hoop, not wanting to have the basketball careen off the rim and hit his baby. Foz stood beneath the rim, cradling a ball in his hands. Dell had played basketball with Foz when both were younger, and his back wasn't about to seize. Foz was surprisingly agile for his size and proudly proclaimed that he'd played power forward in high school. As Dell got out of the car, he heard a radio broadcasting the final innings of the Mariners game.
You should have been here an hour ago, Foz said. Vera made a salmon to die for.
He tossed the basketball to Dell, who caught it but tossed it back.
I better not. The back is still gimpy. I'm liable to shoot and end up in an ambulance.
Foz banked a shot off the backboard. It kissed the front rim and rolled off.
How was your day off? Dell asked.
I'm playing basketball outside, aren't I? Foz said.
On leave less than 24 hours, and I'm already going stir-crazy and driving Vera nuts. You want a beer or a glass of wine?
No, I'm good. Came by to talk.
I figured as much. Foz nodded to the patio table and chairs on the deck. Let's talk outside.
He tossed the ball over his shoulder. It bounced twice and settled in the bushes along the driveway. They heard crowd noise, cheering, coming from the radio on the patio table.
They went in again?
Dell asked, pulling out a chair. After a slow start, the Mariners had won 9 out of 10 games.
4-0, last I heard, Foz said. Sounds like more.
Dell settled across the table from Foz.
I went back to South Park tonight, to Lopez's apartment building.
Yeah?
Foz smiled. When we talked this afternoon, you said Nolasco told you to send the file to narcotics?
I haven't quite gotten around to it.
Dell smiled. I had to go out there to tell Rogers' family about the ballistics report.
How'd they take it?
About as I expected. They still think Lopez worked for little Jimmy. I told them we were still trying to make that connection.
Since I happened to be in the area, I decided I'd drive over and talk to Lopez's neighbor.
Foz sat forward, forearms on the table.
Did she talk to you?
She wasn't about to.
Dell told Foz about the encounter in the hallway.
She was scared, Foz.
Little Jimmy?
Dell shook his head.
No. She's afraid of us, the police.
Foz gave that some thought.
She didn't want anyone to see her talking to you?
Maybe. But it wasn't a general fear of the police. It was more specific.
Foz gave him an inquisitive look.
Of what?
Of who? Gonzalez. I asked Reynoso, who told her to say she heard a man yell gun.
And she said Gonzalez told her?
Foz asked.
After some hemming and hawing, she said the woman police officer told her to say she heard a man yell gun.
No shit.
Dell nodded.
No shit.
He told Foz the details of his encounter at the apartment.
Gonzalez told Reynoso she could get in trouble for letting Lopez into her apartment, that things could get bad for her and for her son.
Did you tape her?
Foz asked. He shook his head.
Nah, I was worried she'd spook and clam up. But even if she went on the record, FIT or whoever else looked into this would argue that I tainted her testimony and tampered with a witness, especially since I told her you were wearing a body camera, so we knew she was lying when she said she heard a man.
Foz sat back from the table.
You said that?
Dell nodded.
Shit, Dell. I don't want you to put your job at risk.
Yeah, well, there's more to it,
Dell said.
When Nolasco told me to close down our investigation and send the file to narcotics, I went into the file to update the binder. I saw that Tracy had opened the file Monday and Tuesday afternoon of this week.
Why would Tracy...
Wait.
Tracy was in the Stevenson trial Monday and Tuesday afternoon.
I know.
Then...
There was another record of me logging into the file yesterday, when I was home with a bad back.
Did you remote in?
Dell shook his head.
No, I was going to ask you the same question.
Oh, shit, Dell.
What?
Damn, Foz said. I let Gonzalez use your computer yesterday, after she gave me a song and dance about her and Tracy having problems. I gave her your password.
Dell nodded, thinking about it.
And if she'd used Tracy's computer on Monday or Tuesday, she would have known I was the lead detective on Rogers, not Tracy, and that she couldn't get into the privatized report files.
Why, though? Why would she want to get into your files?
I don't know. But her interest was clearly Monique Rogers.
Did you ask Reynoso why Lopez was at her apartment?
Foz asked.
I did, and she said Lopez needed to hide from someone.
He knew we were coming?
I don't think so.
Then who?
Reynoso said Lopez was inside her apartment when someone knocked on his door.
You told me you and Gonzalez never knocked.
That's true. We didn't.
So someone got to Lopez's apartment just before you and Gonzalez.
Reynoso said they knocked several times, then left. She said after the person stopped knocking, Lopez went to the window and watched the parking lot. And while he was doing that, his phone rang and he started talking in Spanish.
I heard someone speak in Spanish,
Dell said.
I know. I also don't think Lopez was expecting anyone to still be in the hall when he came out. I think he thought whoever he was hiding from had left.
There are no peepholes in the doors, so Lopez couldn't have checked the hallway before opening the door. I'm thinking that you and Gonzalez surprised him as much as he surprised you.
Foz recalled something else. Gonzalez asked to run Eduardo Lopez, he said, leaning forward. She was there when I got the results from Leighton's on the handprint. She asked if I wanted help running Lopez.
So, she knew we had a positive hit on Lopez, Dell said. And when she ran Lopez, she had his last known address.
You think she told Lopez we were coming to pick him up?
Maybe, Dell said. But that doesn't explain who came to Lopez's door before you, who Lopez was hiding from.
Foz recalled the man who'd come down the stairs just before he and Gonzalez stepped onto the elevator. The timing was right.
I might have seen him.
Who?
I don't know who, but Gonzalez and I saw a Hispanic man come out of the stairwell when we were waiting for the elevator. He gave us a look, and when he left the building, he walked in the direction of the parking lot.
And according to Reynoso, Lopez went to the window and watched him leave, Dell said.
That's just about how long it would have taken for us to get up to the apartment. But if Gonzalez told Lopez we were coming, why'd she shoot him?
Foz asked.
Maybe she didn't tell him. Maybe she told the other guy. And when he knocked on the door and got no answer, he figured Lopez wasn't home.
Still doesn't explain why she'd shoot him.
I can't answer that, not yet, Dell said. All I'm certain about at this point is a dead man can't testify against little Jimmy. And Gonzalez shooting Lopez pretty much put an end to our investigation, especially since the ballistics for the bullet that killed Monique Rogers matches the .38 in Lopez's apartment.
We don't have enough to accuse her, Foz said. I mean, we get Reynoso to say Gonzalez told her what to say, and Gonzalez will just deny it.
And if it comes out that I lied and told her you are wearing a body camera,
your balls will be frying right next to mine.
Dell nodded.
I'm going to give Los Angeles a call tomorrow and see if I can talk to some people down there. Try to find out what they know about her.
Run an address for her, Foz asked.
I can't do that. You know that, Foz.
Officers were not supposed to run addresses unless the address related to a specific case.
Just give me an address. I'm going stir-crazy sitting here. Let me keep an eye on Gonzalez while she's off duty. Has anyone checked Lopez's phone to find out who he was calling or texting?
Not yet. I drove straight here. I'll get on it tomorrow.
Dell sat back, shaking his head. After a few moments, he said,
What a shitstorm.
A shitstorm within a shitstorm, Foz agreed.
40. Armed with a smiling picture of Shay in a medical coat, as well as the DMV report indicating he drove a white 2017 Tesla Model X, Tracy and Kins pulled into the parking structure for the medical complex late Friday afternoon. Tracy had called the clinic again, posing as a mother with a sick daughter, and trying to see Shay that afternoon. She was told he was booked. Parking spaces for doctors' cars were located on the ground floor closest to the building entrance. They did not see a white Tesla.
That car has a price tag of about $125,000, Kin said, as they pulled into the parking lot and found a parking space. So I'm guessing we should only see two or three.
My dad was a doctor and he drove a truck, Tracy said. If Shay is driving a $100,000 car and living in Medina, he either comes from money or he married into it. It's rare these days for a pediatrician to earn that kind of money in medicine.
Not to mention spending a couple thousand a month on a concubine.
Not to mention, Tracy said. A white Tesla entered the parking structure.
That's his car.
And that's him, Kin said when Shay pulled into a doctor's parking stall and stepped out. The back doors of the car rose like the wings of a bird.
Tracy and Kins quickly approached. Dr. Shay? Tracy said. Shay had removed a sport coat from the back seat and startled at the sound of his name. His eyes narrowed.
Yes?
Tracy flashed her badge. I'm Detective Crosswhite. This is Detective Rowe. Can we have a minute?
What about?
Vita Kumari, Tracy said. Shay's eyes flashed recognition, but he said,
I don't know anyone by that name.
Yeah, you do, Kin said. So don't go there, okay? We know all about the sugar dating, sugar babies and sugar daddies. You'd be the daddy. She'd be the baby. Am I right?
Shay instantly deflated, which had been Kinz's intent.
What is it you want?
Maybe it would be better if we spoke in your office rather than here in a parking lot, Tracy said.
Did something happen to Vita? Shay asked. His concern sounded sincere, but officers said Ted Bundy had also sounded sincere.
Why do you ask? Kin said.
Because I have two detectives standing outside my car telling me they want to talk to me about Vita.
Kins looked at Tracy.
Good point.
Yes, Tracy said to Shay. Something happened to her.
Shay looked across the garage to the sliding glass doors of the building. Follow me.
He led them up a stairwell and used a key to unlock an interior door. They followed him along a hallway carpeted with railroad tracks and train cars that meandered past a mural of an African safari with monkeys in the trees, elephants and lions, and a cheetah lying on a branch overhanging a river. They continued down a hall cluttered with weight and height scales and eye charts.
Dr. Shay, a woman in a blue uniform, stepped from one of the patient rooms. Her eyes drifted to Tracy and Kins. I thought you'd left for the evening.
Surprisingly, Shay introduced them as Seattle detectives.
I came back to do a little paperwork. Hopefully I won't be long.
Shay stepped to a door with his name on an engraved plate and pushed it open. The furnishings were austere for someone driving such an expensive car. Shades, the see-through variety, covered his window. He had a view of the 405 freeway.
Have a seat.
Shay gestured to two chairs and moved behind his desk, which had a light veneer, in keeping with the office decor. A large computer screen took up much of the surface. On the wall behind him hung several framed degrees. He'd attended Gonzaga University. The Jesuits would surely not condone his sugar daddy profile. Had obtained his medical degree from the University of Washington and was board certified in pediatrics. He sat.
You said something happened to Vita?
When's the last time you saw Kavita? Tracy asked.
Monday night.
What did you do? Shay cleared his throat. He looked younger than his 44 years. He had a habit of pushing blonde strands of a boyish haircut from his forehead.
We went to dinner, then to a hotel in Kirkland, as was our routine.
Where did you go to dinner? Tracy asked.
Lila's Cafe. It's in Kirkland. The reservation was in my name.
And the hotel?
The Marriott, also in Kirkland.
Also in your name? Kin said.
Tracy kept notes. If Shay was trying to hide anything, he was doing a poor job of it. No, Shay said. Was the reservation under Kavita's name? Kins asked. Yes. Fairly bold actions for a married man living in Medina, isn't it? Kins said. Weren't you worried about being seen?
Shay sat back. He loosened his tie and unbuttoned the collar of his shirt.
If anyone saw us at dinner, Vita was a student looking to practice pediatric medicine.
And what was she at the hotel? Kins asked. God, he could be a sarcastic pain in the ass when they needed him to be.
We never went into the hotel together, Shay said. Vita always obtained the room.
And the hotel management never asked her why she needed a room the same day and time every week? Kins asked.
She told them she was in pharmaceutical sales and met with clients on the east side early Tuesday mornings. She brought luggage with her.
This was all very neat.
So this was a standing engagement, Tracy said. For the most part, yes.
What does that mean, Tracy said.
It means we met on Monday nights unless something came up for either of us.
How would you let each other know if something came up, Tracy asked.
We would text. Sometimes we'd call.
Tracy glanced at Kins. How often did that happen where one of you would have to change your plans? She didn't care. She was more interested in Shay's comment that they texted each other.
Rarely. I don't remember it happening.
And did you text for other reasons?
Only to confirm our meetings and locations. You didn't ask if she liked piña coladas and getting caught in the rain? Kins said, deliberately trying to provoke Shay to determine if he had a short fuse and was easily prone to anger. Shay looked directly at Kins. No, he said. Tracy said, you used your phone to send these texts? Weren't you worried about your wife reading your messages?
Shay shook his head.
I never used my phone. We each had burner phones.
Kavita also? Tracy asked. This was news to them. Only her personal cell phone had been found in the hole. Shay would have known to take the burner phone if he'd killed her. But then why would he tell them about it? Could he have thought this through and decided that if questioned, he'd bring up the subject of the burner phones for that very reason, because it wouldn't make sense for him to do so if guilty?
Yes, he said.
Did you text to confirm your Monday meeting this week?
Yes.
And did Vita respond?
Yes.
Do you have your phone? Shay used a key on his ring and opened the bottom drawer of his desk. He pulled out a cheap cell phone, powered it up, and entered a password. After a minute, he handed Tracy the phone. Kavita Mukherjee had confirmed their date Monday night at 4:14 p.m. She then texted him again at just after 5:30 to say she was running late due to traffic. Tracy suspected that wasn't the truth, since that was the night Aditi had come home and told her she was married and moving to London with her husband. More important, whoever had killed Vita had taken her burner phone, but not her cell phone. Again, Tracy wondered if the act was deliberate, to throw them off. Shay certainly had reason to do so. Tracy looked to Kins before redirecting her attention to Shay. Why Monday nights?
My wife has book club the first and third Mondays of every month. Girls' night out. So she says.
Who watches your daughters? Tracy asked. The fact that Tracy knew he had daughters caused Shay to pause, which had been her intent. She wanted Shay to think they already knew a lot more than they did.
We have a nanny.
Does your wife work? Kin said. Shay chuckled at this.
God, no.
She's one of the Umberto children. You know, the chain tool shops.
I thought I read in the newspaper that the family sold those stores a few years back, Kin said. A couple hundred million, wasn't it?
286 million, Shay said.
But the family remained a part of the board for 5 years. Last year they didn't like how the stores were being run and bought them back. They have what you might call disposable income.
Why did you say, so she says, when I asked where your wife goes on Monday nights? Tracy asked. Shay sat back, rocking in his chair.
I suspect that my wife has a boyfriend, and it isn't her first.
Kins nodded.
And you thought you'd do the same?
Shay shrugged. So why a sugar baby? Tracy said.
Because I can't very well go out and pick up somebody at the local gym or the coffee shop, can I? My wife's family is well known all over the East Side.
And if your wife found out, it would be the excuse to kick you out, and she'd be gone, along with all her money, Kin said.
Maybe, detective. She isn't necessarily setting the moral high ground, but with that much money, you tend to establish the morals.
Why don't you just divorce? Kin said.
Because we have two daughters under 10 who adore their father. Their mother, not so much. So we make things work. For them.
How many sugar babies do you have? Tracy asked, stumbling over the words sugar babies.
I had three, Kavita and two others.
Where did you find the time and the stamina? Kins asked.
I saw the other two lists frequently, maybe once every couple of months.
You saw those two separately or together? Kins asked. Shay took a moment.
Together.
A threesome, Kins said, continuing to pick at the scab to see if it would bleed.
How did you keep the payments to Vita and these other two girls from your wife? Kins asked. I made direct deposits from my account into Vita's account. It's numbered, no names. If asked, I could say it was the health club payment. Not that it would matter. My wife pays no attention to our finances, especially mine. She doesn't have to. We have a money manager for her trust, but she can pretty much do what she wants with it. My income, by comparison, is minuscule and of little interest to her. I paid the other two girls cash.
When you saw Kavita Monday night, what was she like? What was her demeanor? Tracy asked.
Shay gave this some thought, as if he'd already forgotten. She seemed fine, but then that was part of our agreement.
Agreement? Kins asked.
We had a written agreement forbidding questions about our personal lives or discussing our personal problems.
Nothing that could put a damper on the sex, Kins said. Did Kavita ever mention a boyfriend? Tracy asked. Shay shook his head.
What did you talk about when you were together? Kins asked. Many things. Vita is very knowledgeable on many subjects. She wants to be a pediatrician. She asked me about my practice and my patients. She's very interested in world and local news and surprisingly knowledgeable about sports, particularly the Seahawks. Our evenings were enjoyable. I looked forward to them.
So you didn't notice anything out of the ordinary that evening? Tracy said.
Actually, there was something. Vita advised me that she was ending our agreement. Shay said this matter-of-factly, without emotion, and Tracy wondered if he'd rehearsed it, perhaps anticipating this moment also.
Did she say why? Tracy said.
She told me she had enough money to at least start medical school, and that had always been her goal.
And this came out of the blue? Kins asked.
No. She had told me up front that she was trying to earn money to attend medical school and that she'd quit when she did.
Did she say anything else? Tracy asked.
Shay shrugged. Nothing that I recall.
Part of the don't burden me with your personal crap clause of the agreement, Kins said.
I don't know, Detective. She said there'd been some changes in her life, that she intended to apply to schools in the fall and to use her free time to study for the MCATs.
And how did you feel about that? Tracy said.
I was happy for her, Shay said without hesitation. She's a smart girl. She'll make a good doctor.
Tracy noticed the present tense.
How did you feel about her moving on? Kins asked. Disappointed. I enjoyed our time together, and the relationship had become stable. I was going to have to decide whether I wanted to start all over again.
Were you upset? Tracy said.
No, Shay said. As I said, we both knew from the start that this was not about developing a future relationship. That was never going to happen.
So how did you feel about her? Kins asked.
It doesn't sound like it was love. What was it?
Shay gave that question some thought.
I guess I thought of her as a business associate.
And this was just, what, her exercising a clause in that business agreement? Kins said.
That was always on the table, for both of us.
What time did you leave the hotel Monday night? Tracy asked.
Around 9, a little before. It was still light out. I always left at the same time. My wife usually got home from her book club at 9:30.
And Vita, when did she leave? Tracy said.
I have no idea. As I said, I left before her. She was free to use the room for the night if she chose, or to go home.
You left her alone in the hotel room? Kins said.
Always.
How often did she spend the night? Kins asked.
I really don't know.
Also, not something you discussed.
No.
Your nanny can confirm the time that you returned home that night?
Yes. As I said, it's always the same time.
What's her name? Tracy asked. Shay provided the name of the nanny, and Tracy wrote that down, along with the young woman's phone number. Then she asked, what name did Kavita check in under? Shay shrugged.
I assume Vita Kumari.
Kin sat forward, his arms resting on the desk. Dr. Shay, did you consider this relationship to be just a wee bit exploitative? Tracy wanted to roll her eyes, but given the gravity of the situation, she refrained. Shay sat back. He looked tired.
Look, detectives, I recognize the relationship was out of the ordinary, but it worked for me. For both of us.
He shrugged.
What were my options? Go out to a bar and pick up women? I wasn't much good at that when I was young. I doubt I would be much better now. Plus, then you're dealing with different people, STDs, and who knows what else. And when did I have the time to go out and do that?
He paused as if awaiting an answer.
Then he said, I heard about this dating site and I created a profile, just to see what might happen. For the first 6 months, it was pretty much the shits. The women were not very interesting. I was just about to call it quits when I saw this profile of a beautiful young woman. She said she wanted tuition money to attend medical school. It was refreshing. Did it feel wrong? Yes, to a certain degree. But I figured that this way, at the very least, I could do some good with my money.
So what, you're just like Sally Mae? Kins said, referencing the student loan service. This time, Shay did not back down.
In a sense, I guess I am, detective.
And those other two girls who you have the threesome with, are you paying their school tuition also? Shay ignored him. What name did you use on the site? Tracy asked.
Charles Francis, he said, My first and middle names. You haven't said why you're asking me all these questions. I'm assuming something happened to Vita?
She's dead, Kin said. He and Tracy watched Shay's reaction closely. His eyes narrowed and watered, and he pressed his lips together. After a moment, he said,
How?
The word caught in his throat. Tracy didn't think he was acting, but she couldn't be certain.
That's what we're trying to determine.
But you believe someone killed her, that's why you're here. You think I had something to do with Vita's death?
Did you? Kins asked.
No,
Shay said, looking between them.
Then he said, My God, in a quiet voice, do I need an attorney?
I don't know, Doctor. That's up to you, Kin said.
We're just here to ask questions and try to piece together, as best we can, Kavita's evening.
I left her in the hotel room, Shay said. Alive.
41. Saturday, July 14th, 2018. Faz adjusted in his car seat, his body already developing aches and pains from sitting for too long. He had the window down. The temperature remained tolerable, though the weatherman had predicted a weekend high of 92 in Seattle. Faz had arrived in Seattle's Capitol Hill neighborhood at just after 6 that morning. Upon his arrival, he'd driven down the driveway of the three-story apartment building to confirm that Gonzalez's red Audi A8 was parked in one of the tenant stalls. It was a nice car, though an older model. Still, it made Faz wonder if Gonzalez was somehow supplementing her income. He'd retreated and parked his Subaru facing south on 12th Avenue, across the street from the apartment building and the lone driveway out, and settled in to wait. That had been close to 6 hours ago. Faz checked his phone but did not find any messages from Dell, whom he knew was making phone calls to Los Angeles, trying to get whatever information he could on Andrea Gonzalez. He took a sip of water from one of the bottles in the small cooler on the passenger seat. He'd told Vera that he had a follow-up visit with a psychiatrist and a meeting with one of the union lawyers, and that he anticipated being out for most of the day. He didn't like lying to her, but given the circumstances, he also didn't want to add to her worries. Faz sat up when the sun glinted off the polished hood of the red Audi cresting the inclined driveway. The Audi stopped to allow a northbound car to pass, then turned away from him. Faz put the bottle back in the cooler, started the Subaru, and pulled away from the curb. Faz knew the Capitol Hill area well. Half a block west at Cal Anderson Park, he and Vera had enjoyed picnics while watching Antonio play baseball and soccer. They were also close to the freeway entrances for Interstate 5. Gonzalez turned left onto Denny Way and took the on-ramp south. Faz stayed in the right lane, several cars behind the Audi, just in case Gonzalez exited suddenly, a trick to detect surveillance. She drove past downtown Seattle, where the traffic became congested and ultimately slowed to a crawl. Faz had to be careful to remain behind the Audi, which was not easy with traffic in the lanes proceeding unevenly. Though he wore dark sunglasses and a Mariners baseball cap, Dell said disguising Faz was like trying to hide a grizzly behind a hanky. Gonzalez drove the Audi past the exits for the International District. She wasn't switching lanes or increasing and decreasing her speed, another technique to detect surveillance. Minutes later, she exited onto Corson Avenue, still heading southwest toward Georgetown, though Faz suspected Georgetown would not be her final stop. He sat up, feeling nerves of anticipation. At Marginal Way, Gonzalez turned left toward Boeing Field. Faz slowed again when the traffic lightened, not wanting to get too close. He watched Gonzalez turn right on 16th Avenue South, toward the South Park Bridge over the Duwamish. Bingo, he said. It was possible Gonzalez was just visiting friends, but the odds of that were about as low as the odds that Sandy Blaysmith had driven into South Park to meet with a fitness trainer. Faz didn't believe in coincidences. People usually had a purpose for their actions, and he suspected Gonzalez had a purpose that afternoon. Gonzalez turned onto Cloverdale, but drove past the house where Faz and Dell had confronted little Jimmy. The car and foot traffic increased. Families dressed for the summer weather walked the sidewalks, all seemingly headed in the same direction, like fans walking to the start of a sporting event or a concert.
Gonzalez turned on 8th Avenue South, then again on South Sullivan. Faz followed and saw signs for the South Park Community Center. Farther down the road, he noted white tents pitched on the grass field adjacent to the center. With the window down, he heard the horns of a mariachi band, and he smelled food cooking. When he reached the corner, he decided not to turn, in case Gonzalez was now paying closer attention, but he also had to be careful he didn't lose her in the crowd if she got out of her car. The Audi slowed and turned into the community center parking lot, though the lot looked to be full. Faz pulled to the curb across the street, blocking a driveway, and watched Gonzalez drive her car onto the lawn. A parking attendant quickly approached her, but whatever Gonzalez said or showed him, likely her police ID, it was enough for the attendant not to hassle her. When Gonzalez got out of the car, Faz paid particular attention to her clothing, sunglasses, white shorts, tennis shoes, and a blue t-shirt. She reached back inside the Audi and retrieved a floppy hat, placing it on her head. The brim drooped low, partially obscuring her face. Whatever her purpose, Gonzalez did not want to be identified. The hat, however, would make her easier to follow. She walked across the lawn toward the white tents. Faz saw a parked car pull away from the curb and quickly took the vacated spot. An enterprising young man approached the driver's side window and asked for a $5 parking fee. Faz paid the ransom, ditched his blue windbreaker in the back seat, and crossed 8th Avenue into the park. People strolled the lawn, some eating corn on the cob, others soft tacos and churros. The booths displayed Latino art, paintings, and other trinkets. Faz picked up a brochure from one of the tables, declined a sample of food, and looked over the crowd for the drooping hat and blue top. He didn't see her. He migrated through the crowd, listening to the guitars and trumpets. Women in bright colored dresses danced on a stage. In the center of the grass field, a wrestling ring had been erected, and wrestlers, dressed in ornate luchador masks, colorful tights, and knee-high boots, mingled with the crowd. Faz continued to search, going from one tent to the next. He crossed the lawn and started up the other side, looking in the booths and at the people lined up for the food trucks. Beads of sweat trickled from beneath his hat and down his temples and cheeks. He jerked to a stop when he saw the hat and blue top disappear around the back of a tent. Rather than follow, he moved farther down the lawn to the other side of the tent. Gonzalez emerged into the gap between the two tents. She had her head down and appeared to be texting on her phone, unaware of Faz's presence. Faz angled his body, as if interested in the wrestlers, but kept an eye on Gonzalez, who lowered her phone and paced. A man walked down the alley. He had his back to the field, preventing Faz from getting a good look at his face. Faz retrieved his phone as if to take a picture of the wrestlers, flipped the view, and angled the camera until he could see behind him. Gonzalez stood speaking to the man. Faz was about to snap a picture when someone bumped him, knocking the phone off center.
"Sorry," a young man said.
Faz smiled.
"No worries."
He redirected the phone to the gap between the two tents. Gonzalez and the man were gone. Faz turned, searching. Gonzalez was crossing the field in the direction of her parked car. Whatever she had come to say, she'd apparently said it. Though Faz wanted to follow her, he sensed it more important to follow the man, try to get a picture, and learn his identity. He turned back to the tents but didn't initially see the man. Three tents down, he saw him step into the back of a tent where a woman sold beaded trinkets and two young children sat at a nearby table, sliding beads onto string. The man and woman spoke briefly, but Faz saw his face only in profile. The man kissed her and bent and kissed the two children. Then he turned and disappeared out the back of the tent before Faz could get a good look at his face. About to follow, Faz stopped when the man quickly returned, apparently in response to a question from the woman, giving Faz a good look at his face. He wore dark sunglasses and a baseball hat, but Faz was certain he recognized him. 42. Tracy called Kelly Rosa. "Did you complete your report yet for Kavita Mukherjee?"
"Working on it," Rosa said. "But you're not the only one calling."
"Bellevue?"
"Yep, last night before I went home."
"How long can you stall?"
"They're asking for my preliminary findings, so I'd say not long."
Kaylee Wright had said much the same thing when Tracy called her. She'd have to provide Bellevue with something soon. Tracy and Kins drove to Park 95 to pick up the flash drive onto which Andrei Vilkotsky had copied 6 months of Kavita Mukherjee's text messages from her phone and to find out where Katie Pryor was on securing other court orders. Tracy loaded the flash drive onto her laptop, and she and Kins went through the information. Nolasco had tried to call each of them late Friday afternoon, but they hadn't taken his calls, anticipating that he was calling to tell them to transfer the file to Bellevue.
"Some nasty text messages from her brother," Kins said, stretching his back. "He's a piece of work."
Tracy had typed Nikhil into her search window and pulled up his text messages to his sister. She read a message in which Nikhil told Kavita that her disobedience of her mother and father's wishes was juvenile and disrespectful. "You are causing unnecessary stress and aggravation for the whole family. Are you so ashamed to be Indian that you would go so far as to hurt Ma and Baba? It is time you came home and stopped behaving like a child."
"Do we know Nikhil's whereabouts Monday night?" Kins asked.
"Home with his mother and grandparents," Tracy said. "The father was returning from a business trip to Los Angeles, and Sam spent the night at a friend's home after a soccer game. Should be easy enough to confirm."
"She didn't respond to any of Nikhil's text messages. That had to piss him off, don't you think?" Kins asked.
"Or he was used to it." Tracy read the text messages Aditi had sent Monday night and Tuesday morning, expressing concern and imploring Kavita to respond. She also found the text message Sam, Kavita's younger brother, had sent Monday night. "Hi, Vita. I was just thinking of you and wondering what you're doing. I have a soccer game tonight at Roosevelt near your apartment. It's at 6. Ma and Baba cannot attend, so it will just be me. I was hoping you would come." Kavita responded to her younger brother almost immediately. "Hi, Sam. Thanks for the invite. I miss you. Today has been very hard. I suppose you heard that Aditi is married. I'm betting everyone knows by now. She came back from India and moved out of our apartment. She's moving to London. Her husband is an engineer. I feel so alone, Sam. I feel like I've lost a sister. I can only imagine what Ma had to say when she heard the news. Mrs. Dasgupta must be throwing it in her face. I wish I could come to your game, but I can't tonight. I have a date. I'll be thinking good thoughts for you. Text me when the game is over and tell me how you did. I love you, little brother."
"The date had to be with Shay," Kins said.
"Definitely."
"And the last line asking Sam to text her?" Kins said, pointing to the screen. "That's not a woman thinking of killing herself."
Tracy agreed. She read Sam's response sent after the game. "Vita, we won. I didn't score, but I played well. Call me when you get home. I'm staying at my friend's tonight, so I'll have my phone."
"What did he mean by I'll have my phone?" Kins asked.
"The mother takes his phone at night," Tracy said.
"Shanna does the same thing. If she didn't, the boys would never get their homework done."
Tracy read the message Sam sent Kavita later that evening, after 10 at night. "Vita, did you get my message? I called, but you didn't answer. Call me." Sam sent a third message Tuesday, after Tracy and Katie Pryor had visited the family. "Vita, are you there? The police were here looking for you. Everyone is worried about you. Ma and Baba are worried. I'm worried. Please, if you get this, could you call?"
There was also a text message from Nikhil.
"Vita, the police have come looking for you. You need to stop this nonsense and come home."
"Nothing from the mother or father," Tracy said. "That's odd, isn't it?"
"Seems odd to me," Kins said. "Maybe they asked Sam and Nikhil to contact her. I know Shanna would be texting every 5 minutes."
"Seems odd," Tracy said again, thinking of her own mother and father when Tracy's sister had disappeared. She and her parents hadn't had the luxury of cell phones then.
43. Foz watched the man exit the back of the tent and walk east, toward 8th Avenue. Though the man wore a baseball-style hat and sunglasses, Foz was sure he was the same person Foz saw in the lobby of Eduardo Lopez's apartment building just before he and Gonzalez went up the elevator. The man had looked at both of them, though his eyes had lingered on Gonzalez. At the time, Foz had thought the prolonged stare had to do with the man deducing that they were detectives. no longer. Gonzalez had come to South Park to give the man a message, or to obtain one, since nothing appeared to have exchanged hands between them. Whatever Gonzalez had said, the man was on the move. So, too, was Gonzalez. At the very least, Foz needed to get a better picture of the man to possibly help identify him. He walked parallel to